Okay.
First of all, let me just record the date. Today is December 21st, 2009. We're in Yerushalayim. I want to say good morning to my students here and to the many all over the world. I know that there are many because I was overwhelmed by all the questions I received for today's press conference, and I hope I can handle most of them. What time doesn't allow for, if I feel there's some important questions left over, I'll deal with it at the start of Shayurim down the line. But I don't want to knock out another day just for a press conference. There's a lot that I want to teach this year. I also want to mention, which is, it always intrigues me, how there's a record snow in New York City. The city schools are closed, highways are shut down, airports are shut, and we're sitting here, sunny, beautiful, I would say spring-like Jerusalem today in the heart of winter. So to put it mildly, perhaps there's one advantage to Aliyah. Also, I want to say thank you to the Kollel. It's the first time I've recalled that the Rebbeim got Hanukkah gifts from the Kollel, bowls of sweet candy. And we're going to use it very constructively this coming Shabbat. We have the Shabbat where we'll all be together for my grandson's bar mitzvah. And I gave the bowl unopened to my daughter and said, let the grandchildren enjoy it and benefit from their grandfathers being a Rebbe in Gris Kollel. Okay, down to the nitty-gritty. And first of all, I want to smack my face and revise a certain attitude I expressed. Students listening to my Shayurim, too gross, not so young anymore, they're both into their 50s, I would imagine. Two students of mine who happen to be named Gross and both grew up on the West Side that barely know each other, but both of them had the same reaction that if I mentioned to you that I also had difficulty understanding Rebbe Aaron Lichtenstein. So you right away say, well, if the Rebbe has difficulty, we have difficulty, so you find another excuse and you don't go to his class. So I have to tell you, I was rebuked and reprimanded, and I want to quote my Talmidim, the Gross boys, that to learn Rebbe Aaron is a privilege. You have to make the effort. We made the effort Friday night. I think we all understood him, even though we had that. You saw I was leaning forward and I was concentrating, but I understood every word that Rebbe Aaron said. To be exposed to Rebbe Aaron is to be exposed to yesteryear, which I'll come back to very shortly this morning. To be exposed to Rebbe Aaron is to see a gon, a real gon, and a real tzaddik up close. And it's worth every effort in the world. If you came to Gris, with all due respect to myself and some of the other Rebbeim, I think will agree with me, to know Rebbe Aaron is a unique moment in time. Now, the question that I got the most, and I have to say, this question haunts me. It pains me. I've spoken about it at length with Rabbi David Miller. There are no words. I don't even want to phrase all that is being asked. But to put it mildly, why do we have so much terrible, terrible scandal in the Torah community? Why are we in a world where week by week, day by day, another scandal breaks of the most hideous, the most terrible nature? I don't have to tell you that we talk about pedophiles. I once was a high school Rebbe. It was not the high school then, it was Reitz, it was a different yeshiva, everything was connected. But I taught on a high school level. On a high school level, a kid is trying to find himself. A Rebbe becomes the most important factor in his life to a certain degree, even more important than his parents. Now you think for a moment, this is a Rebbe teaching him Gemara, teaching him Torah, and that same Rebbe molests him. Is it any wonder that these Rebbeim and its endless and stories, yeshivat, they become murderers. Murderers, pshuto kamashma'o. How many kids have committed suicide later in life because of a high school Rebbe who let them down? And you just saw this in Borough Park, but I know other cases. And, you know, right away people say nothing is proven, nothing is proven. Baloney, nothing is proven. Where there's smoke, there's fire. When it's one case, two cases, three, four, five, six, seven, don't tell me nothing is proven. And newspapers would not, the New York Post may be a scandal sheet, but, you know, there are laws that you have to face when you publish an article. Just now in Israel, thank God, a judge awarded a tremendous settlement against the reporter, Ilana Dayan, who went around saying that an officer in the IDF killed a Palestinian girl, a Vidui Hariga. In other words, the girl was injured and he went and put a bullet in her head. This is what was reported. Totally, absolutely, completely false. Well, halavai, they get the message. And in my opinion, the fine wasn't big enough. It should have been 10 million shekel. Anyway, be it as it may, how can this happen? Why do we suffer? And one person asking the question coined an interesting phrase. He wrote to me, Rebbe, why do we have so much terror? Why do we have so many cholim sheyesh bo sakana la'achirim? That's the phrase he coined. I want to tell you, it's interesting, but there's a rubric in halacha, it's called the rodef. Why do we have so many rodfim that destroy? And in Baltimore, where they interviewed that kid who was destroyed, and again, I shiver, I shake, because I know the person accused. I learned with him in Lakewood. He was older than me. I looked up to him. And that year, I had two boys from Baltimore in the call, and they told me, to them, they said, it's well known he's a pedophile. I can't even think about it. But because of him, all right, the boy didn't commit suicide, thank God. But he eats Chazer on Yom Kippur. I may be paraphrasing it, but you get the message. Why do we have this? And then, of course, the sexual crimes. And right now, the entire world is shaking. I can't get over it. This Menuvel, I don't want to say rabbi, Menuvel, Lev Trapper. It's on the front page of today's New York Post, you should know. And this Menuvel, Lev Trapper, who caused so much anguish in the Torah world. He's the man who started the battle against Nassim Slifkin with dinosaurs. This idiot, Menuvel, doesn't know that there are 100 Gedolei Yisrael who said exactly what Rabbi Slifkin said. But no, he led a battle, wound up, and you have a lot of extremists today, wound up Rabbi Yashiv, etc., etc. The Gaelic. This is the man that led the battle that there's no good Gerit in the world, and this is the man who's it must be in Amaritz to the 50th power, who, and I understand it's true that he met a woman, he was Megayer, and she was wearing pants, and he retroactively annulled the Gerit. I fainted when I heard it. This. Then you start to wonder, what am I, the only Jew left in the world who can learn? So I have to tell you, Aryeh, that Aaron Rakefet danced for joy when he found out that it's the third topic on which I'm in total agreement with the Eidah Haredit. Number one, they don't wear ties. I agree with them wholeheartedly. Tie is the only article of clothing you wear to be a Baal Gaiva. It serves no purpose. At least the belt holds up your pants. What does a tie do? It chokes you. Number two, I agree with them that it's forbidden to wear these beautiful fancy shekels where you take an average looking woman and turn her into a model, a movie starlet with a $1,000 human week shekel. Total agreement. And third of all, I couldn't believe my eyes. Evidently someone from the basement of Eidah Haredit was listening to me let off steam in the kollel. And I said to the kollel, how can you retroactively annul a gerut, a woman wearing pants? I quoted Reb Chaim Moshe Grzynski, the famous Achiesa. I quoted Reb Moshe Feinstein. I learned in the new scandal that the Eidah Haredit based in, with all the members of the Beit Nisayin, sent this Menuvel Shebe Menuvalim a letter telling him that he's an Amoritz Deoraita, that there's no way you can be Mevatel Gerit because a woman wore pants, and they quoted the Achiesa, and they quoted Reb Moshe Feinstein. So it's the third topic on which Aaron Rakefet and the Eidah Haredit are in total, complete agreement. Why is this happening to us? It haunts me. And I've often spoken about Reb David Miller. We grew up, we don't remember a scandal. I had Rebbeim from the 7th grade on. I had Rebbeim, Kedosha Yelyon, the finest, the purest, the most noble, the most inspiring. What has happened to us? Okay, I don't know whether my answers are correct, but I want to propose two answers. I'm positive I'm not wrong. There may be more answers to the question. Number one is a simple factor of numbers. When we were growing up, Torah Jews were few and far between. In all of the Bronx, if you came out of the East Bronx, you could count the Shomer Shabbos families on your two hands. I don't think there were more than 10 in the entire Bronx. So if someone became a Torah Jew, it meant you had to make a commitment. It meant something. There was depth to it. There was commitment. I mean, when I think of my Rebbeim, who would ever dream that a Rebbe teaching you Gemara, Shanghai survivor, would be a pedophile, would be a murderer? It just didn't enter. It was a different ballpark. And the kids who wanted to be B'nai Torah were sincere. Today, Baruch Hashem, we have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews who are Shomer Shabbos. It's a massive movement. When you get involved in a massive movement, of course, you're going to have a certain percent in Shein Tzadik Baruch Hashem Yaseh Kula Tov, Yesh Zalev Adom Ramenu Rav. You're going to have a certain percentage of sickies. So it could be, this is the price we have to pay. We're like Lo Aleinu, the Catholic Church. The New York Times already has made that comparison. I want to rip Kriya when I hear those words. But Lo Aleinu, when you hear the million Shomer Shabbos Jews, you're going to have a certain percentage that are going to be menuvalim, reitzchim, rapists, seducers, pedophiles, well, I think it's pronounced pedophiles correctly, like pediatrician, etc., etc. Could be. And if that's the case, there's very little we can do. In numbers, there's success, and in numbers, there's disaster. But I think there's another much deeper reason. And many of you are caught up in this web. We've made the price for being a Torah Jew too simple, too popular, too widespread. Every kid the age of 13 for his bar mitzvah, in addition to his tefillin, his parents have to spend, what does a Borsellino hat cost? You tell me. 150, I've seen 175, I've seen prices in stores, outrageous. Kid puts on a black hat, it's a ben Torah. The outward manifestations have conquered the world. You want to be a chassid? That's one thing. Chassidus works with its own principles, in its own environment. I spent many lectures on it years ago. And there's some control, because when you're a chassid, you have a rebbe, you have a social order, you're involved with family. You can be a chassid. But the Litvish world became Chassidim. I saw a picture of Chevron Yeshiva in a money race, a Chevron Yeshiva four blocks from here. I yet saw Chevron Yeshiva in 1920 in Chevron. I yet saw Slabatka in 1900 in Lithuania. Ribbono Shel Olam, if I'll show you a picture of Slabatka and show you a picture of the original Chevron and show you a picture of Givat Mordechai, two pictures are one, and one picture is a new phenomenon. Chassidim, 500 fellas, you can't tell one from the other. Everyone is wearing a black hat, a black suit, a uniform. You're frum. You've put the uniform on. And psychologically, outwardly, everyone is frum today. Wow, is it easy to be frum? And with the frum kind, you're taught not just to be this way, but you're taught to be negative to others. I'll never forget walking to the Kotel that Friday night a few years ago, where as I entered Shai Yafo, a grandfather going with his grandson, it was a bar mitzvah gift to the grandson, people from Pittsburgh. asked me how to get to the cult house. I said, walk with me. So we started to talk, and it turns out that this man's son-in-law is a dear student of mine who we made from in BMT, etc. I don't want to go into more detail. I want him to be identified. And this is his grandson. That's my Talmud's nephew. And here's this 13-year-old kid with a tremendous black hat. And the kid starts talking to me, and he wants to know where I teach. And I tell him, Yeshiva University. If I told him I taught in the Buddhist temple, this 13-year-old pinhead who doesn't know how to hold a chumash in his hands properly, who doesn't understand the Mishnah properly yet, who never opened the Gemara with Rashi and Tosfos and Fashteit Aninyan, he looked at me like I told him, I'm a Machalos Shabbos, Ochlein, Nevelet, and Treifet, Boel, Bilot, Asura. This is the education we're all from. There's a word in modern Hebrew, Tag HaMechir. I don't know how to translate that. But the point of entry is so low today. So of course, we come into Frumkeit. We're holier than thou. We're better than thou. But there's another side to the coin. The Torah world, not all of it, part of it, has adopted a sick, anti-Torah attitude towards sex. We've gone crazy. God created the world with men and women. God created a woman to be attractive to a man. I'm not repeating Gemara's, and I spent the year and a half, I gave you every source in the world. If not for that secret attraction, no man would get married. What the heck did we just had a young man, got engaged. What does it mean to get engaged? Just think for a moment, David. Till now, he's his own boss, makes his own decisions, spends his money the way he wants. Now Arye kaput. It's all over. It's like I told my grandson last night, 24 years old, no girl is good enough yet. All right, he's busy, just finished army. I told him, women rule the world. You have to submit to the feminist dynasty. Forget about feminism. This is the way God made the world. Every married man understands this. Baruch Hashem. Women and men. What have I taught my students for 51 years? Don't fear sex. Sanctify sex. Kedoshim tiyu, ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. It's the Torah point of view. You have to have a healthy attitude. You have to have a positive attitude. So we educate everyone. Women are sexual objects. Men are sex predators. Separate buses. In Square Town, they have separate sidewalks. Are you aware of that? Sidewalks for men, sidewalks for women. Separate buses. You get on a bus. Women go to the back. A man gets on with three daughters. A woman gets on with three little boys. I mean, this is sick, sick, and sicker. And what has happened as a result? Sex exists. Sex is here. Sex is within the person. So of course, klapei chutz, he pays the tag mechir. Oh, he's from. Look at the pictures of this menuvel sheba menuvalim leib trapper. Look at the picture. Look at the picture. Oh, he looks from. It's wonderful. Look what came out of this man. Klapei chutz, from. In reality, a sexual fiend who took the name of God and Torah Hashem Tamima and disgraced it. And multiply this by, imagine, a woman wants to convert. Rabbi Blau says he's investigated. I trust my chavruta, Rabbi Yosef Blau, Jerry Blau, he's investigated. The woman really wants to become Jewish. She fell in the hands of this menorah. Imagine what she thinks. Do you know that there was an Av Beitin here in Israel, a Gaon Adir? I quoted one of his svarim to you, but I didn't mention his name on purpose. He went to jail. He died afterwards of cancer. You know what the man did? Before, you know, you've learned the Gemara and Ketubah. I don't like to mouth everything. A person has to have modesty. It's an open Gemara? Fine. You learn the Gemara and Ketubah, Daf Gimel, Daf Dalet, the whole sugya. Why we get married certain days, the hegemon, the rights to live with the women. He lived with the converts before they converted in the synagogue. And this man, Agon, from the finest family, who he was married to. Of course, you can't change human nature. Allah had come of a come in the world in which we live today, when everyone's exposed. Do you think you're going to be able to fight the internet? Gentlemen, I want to declare an Issa on cars. Since cars were invented, 122,999,572 people have been killed by cars. I want to declare an Issa on cars. I'm signing and I'm asking another 99 Gedolei Yisrael in our generation. Everyone is a gone. I'm asking the 199 other Goyim to sign. No, are we going to stop cars? I'm against airplanes. Too much Beetle Torah. People travel too much. You're going to fight the computer? The seichel of some of these rabbonim today, I don't know where they're coming from, but it's not the seichel you get from learning Shas and Paiskim and studying Torah history and Torah Hashkafa and living with Torah for 3,500 years. Me'oz v'yad yimot ha-mashiach. That gives you a different seichel. You can't fight the computer. You have to sanctify the computer. Uvachata b'chayim. That's what life is all about. This is what Torah is all about. This is what Chinuch is all about. We don't succeed all the time. We don't succeed. But at least let's not create murderers, pedophiles, Chilul Hashem. Imagine a woman comes to a rabbi, and she's overwhelmed with his saintliness and his kedusha. And in reality, take a look what the rabbi's mind is on. Hashem Yirachem. This is why it's so important to see Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein up close. This is why what I mentioned to you a few minutes ago becomes so crucial. If I can quote one of the gross boys, he says, Rebbe, even if they don't understand him, just to look at Rabbi Aaron, to see a Gaon V'Tzadik up close, is worth everything. I said to him, why? I didn't know you became a chassid. That sounds like a chassid. I know by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, thousands would come to a Fabrengen and maybe 10% understood Yiddish. But they came to see the Rebbe. And this is the world in which we live, and this may be responsible why today we have so many Rishayim, so many so-called popular language, frum-looking people. Everyone wears a uniform. Everyone has a black hat. The Litvish yeshiva have become like citadels of Hasidus. The old Litvakim that I learned with in Voloshin and Slobodka and Telj and Mir would be mortified to see what became of the Lithuanian idea. You want to be frum, you want to be a Litvak, you have to be a Gadol B'Torah, you have to learn, you have to have sacrifice, you have to have commitment, you have to learn Musa, Chas v'Chalila, that you should give in to your baser, or your basic animal-like instincts, in inclinations. Chas v'Chalila, you should give in to that. And Chilul Hashem begins at home. There are no words for this. No words. And who knows what the next scandal will be. And mind you, I haven't even touched upon the money scandals. What David can tell you is they now started sentencing from the Shminkah scandal in California. There are over 100 people being sentenced to jail. They already began. Earlier this week they sentenced 6 people. They're beginning their jail sentences after Pesach. The judge has rachmanis on them that they shouldn't be in jail before they know the ropes be during Pesach. And Ribbono Shel Olam, Torah Hashem Tamima. And I have to say, I'm proud of my Rebbe. He raised thousands of Talmidim. Not everyone remained from Lo Aleinu. The Rav failed with some. But the overwhelming majority, lekaved ulatiferet, and not involved in scandalous behavior of this type. And we have to do a real cheshbon and nefesh where we've gone wrong. And that 13-year-old kid owes me a big apology with that big hat. He's from, he's a tzaddik, and he's already hating anyone affiliated with YU. That's part. I only hope he had good rabbeim at high school, and I only hope he knows what websites he can go to on a computer and which he can't go. Now, I received a number of questions with the Geirut in America, the famous Geirut, the high profile Geirut, I'll call it. When you're Donald Trump's daughter, obviously it's a newspaper item and it had endless publicity, and all the Lashon Haranics and everyone else got involved, and some of our very eminent YU faculty was involved in the Geirut. I've investigated it, I think, better than anyone in the state of Israel, because I had heart-to-heart talk with some of the key rabbanim involved. I will only say the following to you. Chas v'chalila, to say one word against Ivanka Trump Kushner. She is a giyorit, and she tries her best to be as observant as any other Jew in her community. Yitzchak, sablanot. I'm gonna spell it out in 1 second. I have eyewitness accounts that this lady is shomeret Shabbat as much as anyone in the Kehilat Jeshurun community. She comes to shul every Shabbat. She's faithful. She's dressed properly. She observes and she has feeling. And people who know her say she has embraced Yiddishkeit b'lev u'benefesh. There were some complaints that the young couple was seen in restaurants that were not kosher, etc. So there was an investigation done. And in the Kehila in which she converted, unfortunately, I say, there are many people, I'm told, who eat fish in non-kosher restaurants. They double wrap it in silver foil, they have it heated, and they eat it with vegetables. Do we need these hatayrim today? Not in New York City, that's for sure. You're not starving, you're not traveling, you're not in a position of crisis. I'm not saying if someone is stuck on a desert island and has no access to food and they're willing to take salmon and double wrap it and put it in the oven and take it out and give it to him with fresh vegetables, all right, it's a different question. But I'm not the posek. No one is asking me. And this is the accepted practice in that kehila. And here's where Reb Chaim Meiser, Reb Moshe Feinstein, who I mentioned 20 minutes ago, come to the fore. And Reb Moshe says something amazing. Reb Chaim Meiser already planted the seeds of this thinking, but Reb Moshe spells it out on the American scene. I can't repeat my shiurim of a number of years ago when I spent the whole year on Geirut, but the heart of Reb Moshe is, there's a gemara in Klal Gadol in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Samach Bet, Samach Gimel, Hamitgayer Bein Ha'akom. And it deals with the whole problem of if a person became a Jew and didn't know there was a concept of Shabbos in the world. How many korbanot does he have to bring? Now this became a tremendous question. And the Gemara discusses it. Well, there's one logical question that you have to ask. All the Rishonim ask it. Taisvus al hamakom. How can you be a convert without knowing there's Shabbos in the world? So to make a modern analogy, this person was living among Gentiles. The person learned about Yiddishkeit from a book. The pages on Shabbat were ripped out. What do we see from the Gemara? The conversion is valid. How can the conversion be valid? Because what's involved in conversion? Mila, tefillah, kabbalat mitzvot. The kabbalat mitzvot means what you believe Yiddishkeit to be as you see it practiced. This Jew never saw anyone practicing Shabbos, only later in life he found out about it. But Reb Moshe says, and I paraphrase, I myself, Reb Moshe says, don't get involved in Gerit on the American scene. Aval ani melamed zchut al chavayrai, I can find justification for my friends who do Gerit, because people convert to what they think Yiddishkeit is. And if someone converts in the greater Upper East Side crowd, and this is what people who are members of the Board of Trustees of Yeshiva University practice, so this young lady thinks that this is the total picture. If we have any complaint, it's to ourselves. Here, this young man whom she married is a Yeshiva Day School product, 12 years of Yeshiva Day School. And if you look into Wikipedia, he calls himself, they quote his website, Conservadox. That's my problem. How did he have Rabbeim among them, my own Talmidim, that after 12 years of studying Torah Hashem Tamima, and you come out with the concept Conservadox? So, Chas v'chalila to say a word about this woman, the Yisurim, the Oraita. And anyone listening to me, I investigated, I check. The Gerit was done by the Av Beit Din, was a Gadol b'Yisrael at this moment in time. He was there at the Gerit. He checked afterwards when these rumors started spreading. And this is the situation. And we don't always have to be negative. We have to be moved that a lady of this stature, from this background and this family, really wants to be a Jewish woman, kedat v'kedem. And halavai it'll get better, and she'll go mechayel el chayel. And this takes me back to this woman of today, involved with this menuvel sheb menuvelin, Leib Trapper, from what Rabbi Blau says, and I know Rabbi Blau, Jerry was my chavruta, I love him, we learned together, we grew up together, we serviced the Rav together, and I can tell you he's a sharpshooter, and if he says he checked, and the woman is sincere, the woman, I just read, I think in the Post article today, that the woman says that she really wants to be Jewish, the fact that she fell into the hands of a menuvel doesn't change the fact she wants to be Jewish. And I say to you, kala kavod. I am impressed by a lady who speaks that way. Halavai she would come to Yerushalayim and Rabbi Rubin would already arrange for her conversion. Okay, so that's in relation to the question on the conversion that was so widely spoken about. Now, growing up in the Bronx, I want to come back to the theme I mentioned a moment ago because it plays out in a letter and afterwards in questions. You know that there's a Rabbi Sobolovsky who teaches in Ritz. Are any of you his students? Okay, so you may know that Rabbi Sobolovsky and yours truly have a special relationship. What's our relationship? He's much younger than I am. He could have been my student many times over. No, it's not my student. When I was growing up, there was one family that had a jewelry store in the Tremont Avenue section of the Bronx that was Shomer Shabbos. You have no idea what that meant. The only Shomer Shabbos people were butcher shops, and even probably many of the butchers weren't Shomer Shabbos, but to remain in business, that they kept their shops closed because they had to get a heksha. Pechter's Bakery was Shomer Shabbos. Dumas, they didn't bake Friday night. That is true. And my grandfather worked for Pechter's. My grandfather, my father's father, was never Mechallel Shabbos. Came to America, a teenager, 15, 16, not married, a kid. And he married a woman through her. I have big yichus through that grandmother. I connect with Rabbi Aaron Cohen of Chevron. I connect with Rabbi Revel. I just found out, my mother always told me about this branch of the family, but I never knew the details till a certain book appeared, and I was able to make a deep connection all the way to Rabbi Revel. It's my cousin. So never Mechallel Shabbos. He worked for Pechter's. One of the greatest moments in my life was a kid. He took me to meet his foreman. Now, let me put into your terminology. if you become teachers, it's like meeting the dean of the school. In my grandfather's life, the foreman was second only to the President of the United States. And I remember my grandfather had me recite Shema Yisrael for the foreman. It had to be about 43. A Jewish kid could say Shema Yisrael in the Bronx. He gave me a quarter. You know what a quarter was worth? You figure out, a quarter today is like $10. That's what the foreman gave me because I was able to say Shema Yisrael. Rabbi Sobel, you know the name of the people who owned this store? Their name was Potok. And Rabbi Sobolovsky is a grandson. There were two boys, Chaim Potok, Simon Potok, Zichronam Levracha, was my classmate. We went to school. Chaim the writer, Simon, they were both conservative rabbis. Then there was a younger sister who is Rabbi Sobolovsky's mother. Uncle is Chaim Potok. What are you getting so excited? I owe a great debt to Chaim Potok. He helped me with, he was editor of JPS when my first book was published. He helped me write. He taught me, I write my new book, Certain Tricks. He taught me in writing. He was very, very kind because I was his brother's classmate. I was a Ben Bayit. Simon became a conservative rabbi, died young. He was a conservative rabbi in New Jersey. What's interesting is Rabbi Sobolovsky tells me that all of my classmates' children are Haredim today. Simon's children crossed the board. I think there were four or five children, all are Haredim. Not Chaim, but Simon. Now, so that's my relationship with Rabbi Sobolovsky, and I'll come back to the Potok family later with a different question that I was asked. However, discussing contemporary YU and Yiddishkeit, so I get a question here, was homosexuality ever a topic, and how did the Rav relate to it? So let me tell you, homosexuality never ever was a public topic. Never in all my years in the yeshiva, toevah doesn't mean you shoot or kill a homosexual, God forbid. A homosexual, all right, he's sinning. So how do we react to other people who are sinning? I've yet to hear any Rebbe in the world, at least the Rebbeim I work with, that know it. So you have a kid who did something wrong. You're going to yell at the kid, shoot the kid. You have to try to influence. Homosexuality has become a terrible problem because part of the sexual revolution that kids at the age of 13 and 14 are having sex, or kids can come to Israel for a year, and we spoke about it already, where kids go into an empty apartment, their parents' apartment, their grandparents' apartment, boys, girls, and God have mercy, what goes on today? Okay, part of that revolution, everything honest, good, homosexual, the New York Times, homosexual marriages, guts all uphitten. What became of the world? Now, what's very bad today is there may be a certain percentage. Again, I always find it depends who I ask. Is homosexuality inborn? Is it something nature or nurture? Is it something we learn? Something that's psychological? Or is it something inborn? So when you ask from psychologists, they will tell you it is something people learn. It can be corrected. You'll ask other psychologists, they'll tell you it's inborn. I know that in the Gemara we talk about a tumtum and an adreganus. So you see, there might be a certain percentage of people who are born with this problem. May very well be. Our problem today is much deeper. Because it's acceptable, many people who do not really have the problem find it easier to hide behind the homosexual label. And I've checked on some of the research on this topic because I've had students who have struggled with it. If you are anyone here have four older sisters, and he's the little boy in the family, the only son. It's very interesting. Sometimes there's a problem of homosexuality of a kid raised in a family where the entire stress is feministic. That's one case that comes up. There's another case. Do you have an overbearing mother who smothers you and doesn't let you express yourself? They claim that that too contributes. The problem today is because trembling before God and everyone is talking about it and movies are being shown. And there was a fellow who studied in Israel, stayed at the home of a Talmud of mine for many Shabbatot. He was from the same community. And today that same person walks around in a dress and he's a woman. And I believe he doesn't put on tefillin anymore, and he can't be counted for a minion, and he declared himself a woman, and he went through an operation. Now, how you can change a man into a woman or a woman into a man is beyond my comprehension. I'm told that it is impossible, that when they say it's a transsexual, if I'm using the right word, operation, it's only to a certain degree can they do something. But there's not really a total transformation. Today we have a terrible problem because the world has a benevolent, accepting attitude. And if that's the case, why should Chaim Yankel make the effort, try to change, try to enable himself to live a more normative life if the New York Times is accepting and this rabbi is accepting and a member of this kollel who studied right in front of me, 1981 was one of my top students, wrote a whole book justifying homosexuality. Right or wrong, the Orthodox homosexual rabbi. All right, this is the real problem. In my days, we never had such a problem. I never ever recall a Rebbe dealing with it, speaking about it. I never recall people declaring themselves homosexuals. I never recall a homosexual club. But today it's
better, it's more common, it's more hidden, and people are forced to struggle.
You're not reading me. And Michael, you're not reading me. You didn't hear what I said 2 minutes ago? I said something very profound. Listen again. That because it's accepted, instead of having 1 out of 100, we have 20 out of 100. And this is the real problem. And if we have to make clear, homosexuality cannot be accepted. We cannot condone it. We cannot accept it. We cannot give it a heksha. And if you have a problem, don't accept the New York Times benign attitude. Do something to help yourself. This, to me, is the problem today. Not that it would be better in the closet. The problem is, instead of dealing with 1 out of 100, I never saw so many closets falling apart and so many people walking out of the closets. And 90% of them are not really homosexuals. It's psychological. It's because of experiences in life. Let me give you a case study. You want a case study? Fine. The Menuvalim I've met in my life, thank God I've met wonderful people too. Holocaust survivors, also a higher percentage of homosexuality. They attributed to parents what they went through, parents being conquered by others, therefore it's much more benign to have a homosexual relationship rather than conquering a member of the opposite sex. There are all types of theories that have evolved. What's true or not true, I don't know. I'm not an expert in psychology, but it certainly makes sense. So this Holocaust survivor's child, an unbelievable, insatiable sexual attitude. And this person was a rabbi. And while studying for the rabbinate in New York, He is seducing woman after woman. One of the women he seduces or rapes, statutory rape, is a woman who was 13 or 14 at the time. Okay? Crawls into a bed, he's tutoring her. She's just switched to Yeshiva High School, he's tutoring her. He's a guest of the family on Shabbat. crawls into her bed Friday night, Friday night after Friday night after Friday night. Hashem Yirachim. Okay, so you should know, this girl had five older siblings. She consulted in the sister right above her, who's my student. That sister became a lesbian. Okay, now you don't have to be a big gong to figure this one out. The girl who was raped by a rabbi later marries a guy and leaves Yiddishkeit. The lesbian could never come back. She hated men with a passion. When she finally, quote, end quote, married another Orthodox lesbian, the New York Times wrote it up as the marriage of the week. Are you familiar with the New York Times and how they zero in Sunday on one marriage? That was the marriage of the week. Two Orthodox lesbians. So you see, you don't have to be a gong to understand what's happening here. And Nebuch, Aaron Rakefet, got the Shiloh from the parents of the girl. Okay, now starting. And Aaron Rakefet got the Shiloh from the girl's parents. Should they go to the wedding? You follow? You deal with the Shiloh like that. Ich bin auch nicht Makana. I'm not envious of you deal with the Shiloh like that. Okay, now. Another question that flows, a very interesting question. You all know that Professor Yerushalmi died, I think a week and a half ago. Let me see if I have the date here of his death. December 10th, 2009. Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. And I got a very interesting question. He was from Columbia and top quality Jewish history. He and Chaim Potok were both Yeshiva College graduates, a few years apart. I think Chaim Potok was about 1950, and Yerushalmi, I think, was 53. Let me see if I have the information here correct. 53, and both went on to the Jewish Theological Seminary. So the question here that I was asked, why did these wonderful, good people leave Yeshiva University and go on to JTS? Okay? It's a very fair question and a very interesting question. So I have to tell you, you have to put your mindset in the 1950s. The 1950s, there was an entire segment of American Jewry, committed American Jewry, who felt the future was with conservative Judaism. There was this feeling that Reform had conquered all. Orthodoxy had no message. It was dead. It was European. It was outlandish. It was outmodish. You have to remember, this was one on 13th Avenue in Borough Park. 90% of the stores were open on Shabbos. Think what I'm telling you. I've told you more than once, my mother's second husband, Morris Appelbach, said, Chrono Levracha, was president of the Shmirat Shabbat Society in Brooklyn. And he and Rabbi Felder, whose grandson is the politician, Rabbi Simcha Felder, he's a state assemblyman, if I'm not mistaken, used to walk up and down 13th Avenue, going to each store, the rabbi and the balabas, my stepfather was a lawyer, and pleading with the store owner to close on Shabbos. Many times they laughed at them. Of course, today, you can't even conceive of that. People, I just spoke with a Talmud of mine, Rabbi Leib Byens in Toronto. He makes pilgrimages with NCSY kids to spend Shabbat in Borough Park in Brooklyn to show them Muncie, Brooklyn, pilgrimages. Those days. So these people really thought the future was with conservative Judaism, which in their eyes was conservadox. Their compromises were very minor compared to today. Yes, they condoned exceeding its services, but the prayer book was orthodox. They believed in karbanot. They didn't change words in the davening. But in order to outreach, we have to give up on the mechitza. And this was the attitude. You can read about it. There was a book, a sociological study of American Jewry, published in the early 1940s by Professor Oskar Janowski, who was a top professor in this field at the City College of New York, which CCNY was then a major institution. And he made the point that Orthodoxy will have to give up the mechitza. There's no way it can continue to thrive or to exist in America. Now, it may be that more than anyone else, it was the Rav who went to battle on the mechitza, came out of his tent, and a man who shied away from any controversy since he was so badly burned in the communist controversy in Boston. And I refer you to Rakefet's work on the Rav, which you all heard what Rabbi Lichtenstein had to say about it. So Baruch Hashem, I'm now in the Matzav Yalalucha Zarim, and I don't have to open my mouth. Hello, Pika. The Rav used to say, that if you have Zarim, if you have strangers who praise you doing your work, your teachings, then you don't have to do it. But if you don't have Zarim, then you have to praise your own work. So Baruch Hashem, I don't have to praise my work, but I make an important point there, and certainly on the tapes, Chris Kolel, I go into great depth and prove my point. Now, that's one side of the coin. With Yerushalmi and Potok, there are two additional factors, each one. Professor Yerushalmi had a bend for scientific Jewish scholarship. In the early 50s, JTS was the place. No one in the Western world could compare to the scientific faculty, Wissenschaft des Judentum, of JPS. No one in the world. You got to remember, you had Professor Saul Lieberman. Just to mention his name, there's no one else on his level. He was in a class all by himself. Just like his first cousin, the Chazon Ish, you understand, the Chazon Ish and Professor Liebman, their mothers were sisters. Just like the Chazon Ish was in a class of learning, when you mention the Chazon Ish, you tremble. Chazon Ish was the Chazon Ish. Professor Liebman was Professor Liebman. In addition, you had Professor Louis Finkelstein, you had Professor Avram Yoshua Heschel, you had top quality people, you had others as well. There was an entire slew of people in the Talmudic department at JTS that were world renowned. Many of them edited Sfarim, the Zimitrovsky, you had Schreiber, you had the Chatam Sofers, the editor of all the Meiris. They all made a living out of the seminary. So I'm a lamed zchut on Yerushalmi. He felt the seminary had a lot more to offer than Bernard Rebel Graduate School at that moment in time. By the way, this has no relevancy today when Bernard Rebel Graduate School is not only the equal of JTS, it's infinitely better. JTS today has no one on that level. There's no one even to speak of in the same terms that we speak of the earlier professors at JTS. At Bernard Rebel Graduate School, you got top quality people there. So that may explain Yerushalmi. Potok explains himself, I don't have to go into detail, if you've studied his books in the beginning, which is many of his books are autobiographical, he was scared out of his wits by some of the Rebbeim at YU. The main Rebbe who scared him out of his wits was Rebbe Ruchim Gerelich. Yitzchak, you're too judgmental. Relax yourself. Yitzchak, relax. But you don't understand. These young men are going into the rabbinate. They have to learn how to deal with evil people. I hope they're going to emulate the example of yours truly. Since when was I mean to people? But they have to deal. Can they get above on them? They're going to have to deal with evil people. We got to prepare them. And they got to know that an evil person, you got to rub off the veneer. And underneath every human being, 90% want to be good human beings. It's like children. Children are not really bad, but you know, they can be wild, they can be boisterous. I'm riding high. I had a bar mitzvah last night. I saw that. What a generation we have raised now. Oh, I saw my grandson's friends, and you should see this kid. Just turned 13 on Sunday, and he's a bout fielder, and he hasn't missed the minion. And I, since he was 11, Baruch Hashem, let me not speak. But thank God. So kids are good. You just have to know how to inspire them. Anyway, where was I? So Rabbi Yerucham Gerelich, pardon the colloquialism, but the Rav used this language, scared the hell out of him. Plain and simple. And Rabbi Yerucham, see, you had to know Rabbi Yerucham. I knew this guy was schizophrenic. I knew he could be angry. A day later, he could be your best friend. He was a volcano. That was his personality. I remember I invited him to, I was making a siyum in Masechet Megillah. So I invited him to Bnei Akiva where the siyum was, to be the guest speaker. He came. Then he was mad at me that there were boys and girls together there. I said, yeah, but Rebbe, they were sitting two sides of the mechitza, you know, the reverential. No, but women, all right. A few days later, there was a kid from his neighborhood who was going to Bronx High School of Science, and I knew the kid, I think, from day camp. I'd been in Madrid, and I influenced the kid to go to MTA. Rabbi Yerucham kissed me and hugged me. Yeah, this was Rabbi Yerucham. So if you saw him at the moments, he was volatile. I write in my book, read my description of him in my Bezrat Hashem, in my new book. You'll see Rabbi Yerucham. I tell a story there with Rabbi Yitzchak Kotner. That's classic, absolutely classic. So that was Rabbi Yerucham. But if you saw him blow off steam, he could frighten you. He frightened Chaim Potok. The other person who frightened Chaim Potok was the Rav. All of you know the stories of the Rav Shayorim, particularly you're talking 1948, 1949, 1950. When I went into the Rav in 1956, 57, whenever it was, he was a tyrant. We sat there, you were frightened out of your wits. You understand? If you said something he didn't like, he could chop your head off. He had not mellowed yet. Forget about what you saw in the documentary when the Rav mellowed. You remember with Aaron Adler's brother? What's his first name? Rabbi Adler of Teaneck. Anyone give me the first name? Adler. He's a dean of a school. And what's his first name? Yosef, Rabbi Yosef, could be Joseph, sounds right, am I right? Anyway, I don't know him well, I know Aaron, I know his younger brother better, but he describes how the Rav mellowed in the 70s, and he was a terror, and people were frightened. So that may explain why Chaim Potok and Professor Yerushalmi went and left Yeshiva College and went on to JTS. Now, there were a lot of questions about the Rav. Let me state first of all, and I couldn't believe how quickly the article on Rav Heschel Schachter, which is essentially an article about the Rav, how quickly the article spreads throughout the world, but this is the computer age. I already received at least 5-6 questions. I have to say that first of all, I compliment Mishpacha for Haredi publication. It is a very open-minded, broad article. That's number one. Number two, I think Rav Heschel Schachter handled himself beautifully. And I agree with every word he said. Where I disagree, it's not that I disagree, it's the way Rav Heschel understood the Rav. I think he's wrong, but he's entitled. Because Reb Heschel makes the point as well. Every Talmud saw the Rav through his own prism. And once you saw the Rav through your own prism, which was inevitable, each one has a different slant of the Rav. So when Reb Heschel describes the Rav as a Rosh Yeshiva, it is very similar to my description in my new book, where I make the point, coming from Lakewood, having heard Shurim from Rav Aaron Cutler, you felt no different in the Rav Shia. It was a Litvish Shia. It was a Lumdish Shia. Yes, there were differences. Rav Aaron was very quick and very rapid and very poor in elocution and getting the ideas out. Rav Aaron, the Rav said this himself, that Rav Aaron Cutler only had the... By the way, it's another question I got. The Rav was very close to Rav Aaron Cutler. I believe he was closer to Rav Aaron Cutler than any other gadol in America, outside of Rav Moshe, where there was a blood relationship, a very close blood relationship. Rav Moshe and the Rav's mother were first cousins, as you all know. But the Rav himself said, what's the difference... between myself and Rav Aaron Cutler, that Rav Aaron teaches the Iluyim. And the Rav always tried to make the Shir understandable to the average fellow in his class. And that was the Rav's Cutler. And you see this in the article. As far as the quote they asked Rav Heschel from David Holzer's book, first of all, the quote is not an accurate quote. Secondly, they changed. They left out a sentence. Secondly, it's taken out of context. Thirdly, I could say the same thing, and I know it's going to accuse me of not being a Zionist, but I often say I'm not a Zionist. I'm a Torah Jew. My Zionism comes from my belief in Torah. I don't understand the Haredim who don't have my Zionism, because my Zionism is Torah B'Shem Tamima. It's the Torah, it's the Ramban, it's the Tzilut Malachim of Maimonides, it's the Ramban on Chumash, on Sefer Mitzvot. I have to tell you, the Ramban Shita. But you notice the way Rav Heschel handles himself. All right, he doesn't maledict the holes of volume the way Rav Aaron did, but he says, well, no, it's not always reliable. He handles it very well. Where I differ with Rav Heschel is his understanding of the Rav vis-a-vis secular studies. There, that's not the Rav, but that's the way they understood the Rav. That's Rav Heschel. Rabbi Meir Tversky, I believe, understands the Rav that way. Rabbi Moshe Meiselman understands the Rav that way, right or wrong. And you say to me, hey, Rakefet, what kind of idiot are you? His own grandson and his own nephew disagree with you. I'll still stand on what I have to say. And you got to remember, we still have Rav Aaron Lichtenstein with us. No one understood the Rav better. They had chutzpah calling Rav Heschel prize Talmud, prize of halachic man. The prize Talmud is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Great Talmud, Rav Heschel. Fine, that I'll agree with. But the prize is Rav Aaron. Alzel Leitman de Pollock. Everyone asks me, who were the Rav's greatest Talmudim? I'll tell you for each generation. Every 10 years, I'll give you a different name whom I think, arguably. It's like arguing who is the greatest center fielder in the 50s. Duke Snyder, Mickey Mantle, or Willie Mays. You know how many arguments? Yitz gave me a watch. I have all three pictures on that watch of the three Gedolim Asher Ba'aretz. So you can argue from today to tomorrow. But the greatest student was Rav Aaron Bramwell. He's the prize. Rav Heschel, it's Rav Heschel. There were others, Tzvi Kanatovsky. You got to know the Rav raised students. Wow. Later period, you have more students, Baruch Hashem. And Rav Aaron considers the greatest student Yaakov Blitzstein, Jerry Blitzstein, Rabbi Blitzstein, Professor Blitzstein of Be'er Sheva University, retired today. Rav Aaron says he's the greatest. I tell you, Rav Aaron is the greatest. Seder, Rav Heschel's right up there in the lights, no question about it. But to think that the Rav only appreciated secular studies because you have to make a living, it's missing the depth of the Rav, the whole outlook, Ervetoshav Anochi Machem, and the Yishalacha, Umilu Taretz Vikivshuo, Verapeye Rapkeh, and everything else I've taught about in 22 years of giving Shurman the Rav and not repeating a word in the Kollel. So there, but... It's not that Rav Heschel is telling him his truth. As he says himself, each Talmud sees the Rav through his own perspective. Okay. Now, then I got the question, How did the Rav relate, the Briska Rav? How did he relate to the Chazon Ish? There's no question that he had a very deep relationship with his uncle. And there's no question that the uncle and nephew in Europe were together. In Europe, they spoke and learning. There's evidently correspondence between them, some of which has never come to light or will not be published or is simply being kept under lock and key. There's no question that the uncle's hesped on the Briska Rav is the most classic presentation of what Brisk was all about. I can only tell you that after the Rav gave that hesped, where I was in the audience, when we walked down, thousands of people, we started heading back to the Bronx. It was late at night. He didn't wait for a bus already. We were all walking, and I was walking with Reb Yeruchim Gerelik. I tell that to those who claim he never taught it. Why, you another story from your friend. He was dancing with joy. He was in ecstasy. Someone wrote into me that in Ish Halakha the Rav describes Brisk. That's wrong. In Ish Halakha the Rav describes Lithuania. Describes the whole development of the stress on halakha vis-a-vis the Hasidic world. But if you want to know what Brisk is, it is in the chesped for Reb Velvel. Now, there's no question that the Rav and Reb Velvel went on different paths. But that was a gradual development. Reb Velvel winds up in Yerushalayim, the Rav winds up in America. The Rav was extremely close to Reb Moshe Feinstein's nephew, Reb Yechiel Michal Feinstein. They were like a father and son. He was mamish ben bayit by the Rav. The Rav brought him to Boston. He taught for the Rav. He helped the Rav with the kollel in Boston. And he later marries the Briska Rav's daughter. This is the famous Reb Yechiel Michal Feinstein, who just died maybe 3-4 years ago. So there certainly was a warm connection there, although there's no doubt that they both went on a different path, particularly regarding general knowledge and Zionism and the modern state of Israel. As far as with the Chazon Ish, I don't believe the Rav had a deep relationship with him. I would venture a guess that the Rav met him when he was in Vilna, at the time that he married Tanya Levitt. Tanya Levitt was a Vilna woman, a Vilna girl. They went back from Germany to Vilna to get married. The Rav spent a number of months there that year. I believe it was 1931. You can correct me if I'm incorrect. I believe the wedding was 31, and if not 30. At that time, the Chazon Ish was sitting in the Beis Medrash in Vilna, in a winkle in a corner, and learning around the clock. His wife supported him. They had no children. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Rav must have spoken and learning with the Chazon Ish. I only know many, many years later, and I always say this as a theory, that in a talk the Rav gave, he mentioned that the greatest thing for a Rosh Yeshiva is that he has students. And students will shoot you down if you make a mistake, if you say something that is incorrect. And the Rav said there's a Gadol Shebegadolim, but he doesn't have students. And sometimes he says psakim, he says thoughts, that had he had students, they would have challenged him, and he would have had to revamp and to revise his thinking. I believe, it's only a guess on my part, the Rav is referring to the Chazon Ish. Because all of you know that many of the psakim of the Chazon Ish are referred to as a chumr from the Chazon Ish, but it didn't become mainstream psak. And I believe the Rav is referring to the Chazon Ish because, as you all know, the Chazon Ish had no students at Gizitzim, Bazik, and Winkel in his home and learned and continued to learn, but he never gave formal shayurim like a Rosh Yeshiva has to give. So I would say, I would believe I'm correct, but on the other hand, I did not hear the name from the Rav. he spoke about this type of person, but didn't want to mention his name because at the time he spoke about it, I believe the Chazon Ish was still alive. Now, then I got this wonderful question, why is it that many Rabbanim's children do not follow the path of their parents and sometimes veer totally off the path? That's a wonderful question, and all I can tell you is to answer that question you have to take courses in psychology, study with Freud, learn about the parent-child relationship, and unfortunately, and we've referred to this in class, many times a child wants to rebel, and there's no greater joy than rebelling against your parents. And lo aleinu, we see this time and again, people who are in the public light have children who will constantly embarrass their parents. The greatest of Rabbanim have had this, politicians have had this, royalty has had this, you can go right down the line. In the present world, at this very moment, we're talking about a terrible problem of the army, Barak versus Yehuda v'Shomron, Gush Emunim. If I can put it in simple language, you're dealing with Ehud Barak, who lives in Uganda. He does not live in Eretz Yisrael. Has no concept of Eretz Yisrael. Can't be angry at him. He never learned the Patzach Chumash in his life. He studied a little Bible like we study Greek and Latin. Yehuda v'Shomron, my children, my grandchildren, they live in Eretz Yisrael. It's a totally different concept, a totally different Weltanschauung, a totally different gestalt, understanding. Who is Ehud Barak? Barak, where did the name come from? Where did Rakefet come from? People always ask me, Rakefet, it's a cyclamen, a flower. What do I have to do with a cyclamen? The cyclamen is right in front of Gris. When I come to Gris, I see Rakefet waving at me. It's a play on words. Rakefet Rothkopf, an anagram. The same letter says Reutkopf, red head. I must have had a great-great-great-grandfather who had a red head. It shows up in my brother's family. So they named the family Reutkopf. Rothkopf. Take Rothkopf, the same four letters, turn into Rakefet. No, where does Barak come from? The original family name is Bork. Who recognizes that name? Who studied with Rakefet when he did the whole year on Musa? When Musa split in half, what were the two great schools that we had, Noah? Gatlet Adam and Shiflet Adam. Where did Shiflet Adam come from? Nevadak. Who was the founder of don't overwhelm me with Slabatka, everyone knows that, but let me see that you know a little bit about Nevadak. That they didn't teach you in Maimonides for many good reasons. They didn't want you to jump off the roof. But Nevadak, listen to my Sheyurim, learn what Nevadak was all about, Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz. Who was his Talmud Mufak? Bork, the Bork rabbinic family of Nevadak, the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz. Read about them in Tenuat HaMusa by Dov Katz. Those are the forebears of Ehud Barak. So that person, you want to know, do you know the person who asked me the question? Do you know a little Yiddish? We have an expression in Yiddish, a rav's atochta, a rabbi's daughter. Is there anyone in this room who's not married? I don't think so. Everyone, well, come on, you're engaged. Don't raise your hand. You're finished. That's it. You're technically not married. Don't play games with me. Baruch Hashem. Although the Gemara tells funny, you know, I quoted a Gemara to you. A funny thing happened to me on the way to the Chuppah. No? Let me tell you one thing. You're lucky you didn't find a Rav Zatochta to marry, or you'd have as much Yiddishkeit as a dead mouse. Let me tell you a little story about Barak's mother. After the Yom Kippur War, there was a great reawakening here, a great hit over Rut. And a lot of people started to become Jewish conscious. As you know, it affects everyone until today and the whole 1 year coming to Israel. So this kibbutz where Barak was born and raised, by a vote of the membership, everyone who wants to put a mezuzah on their front door, the kibbutz will pay for the mezuzah. In the entire kibbutz, two families refused. One of them was Barak's mother, who said, over my dead body, Azei hatarabz tzachta geret. That's the way a rabbi's daughter spoke. So we have our problems. And that's why when you stand in the public light, public thoroughfare, and you raise good children, you have to be thankful to God. And that's why smart people keep their children out of the limelight. Push them aside. You're in the limelight, you're in the limelight. Let your child grow up normally, not feeling the pressure of being a rabbi's son, a machanech son, a principal's son, a dean's son, or like this menuvel sheba menuvalim, Leib Trapper, whose father was a Rebbe in RJJ for many decades. Now, continuing with the Israeli theme, two questions, halacha lemaisa, with two simple answers that no one will listen to. Gilad Shalit. There is no doubt in my mind, al pi halacha, you cannot make the trade that the Israeli government will make. There's no doubt in my mind, ain po din et hashlum yotel de mehem, the Mishnah and Gittin, and even though we paskin, that if someone's going to be executed, we could be, there are those that say if he's going to be executed, then you do everything to redeem him. Here that doesn't apply, because let out and save the life of one individual, you're going to wind up lower lane. I don't want to say percentage-wise what we've seen from the past, how many more Jews will be killed when these murderers, seasoned, experienced, capable murderers, bloodthirsty Arab hordes, how many more they will kill. So al pi halacha, there's not even a shaila here. But our problem is a different problem. First of all, many of the gedolim of today, so-called gedolim, don't paskin al pi halacha, they paskin al pi emotion, al pi psychological instinct, I'll pee political pressure. So I predicted, those of you who heard me say it, I assured you, Shas will be in favor of any swap, even if it means giving up 1 million murderers. And I just heard this morning, Yishai is in favor of giving up 1 million murderers, let them live where they want. And it's against the halacha, go yell, shout. The problem is much deeper, and that's what Rabbi Lichtenstein said. Not a halachic question anymore, it's emotional. And the parents of Gilad Shalit have really made an unbelievable, endless sea of pressure, have produced endless public relations. They have the press, which generally is always leftist, certainly in this case it's leftist to the third power, and everyone is behind them. Let them out, and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein hit the nail on the head. If you see one coffin standing in front of you, it troubles you. Aye, there'll be 150 coffins a few years from now, but that's not realistic, that's not tangible. And that's why the politicians are under such pressure. And if I read through the lines of the news on the radio, the one remaining machloket is that Netanyahu refuses to let the murderers come back to Yehuda Vishomron, let them go to Gaza. And that's what the machloket is about right now. The Hamas says, let them go back to Yehuda Vishomron. Netanya says, only to Gaza. He may change his mind by nightfall because he's meeting with Shalit's parents today. Now, are Shalit's parents acting properly? Absolutely not. But how would you act if it was your son, your child? I'm only raising these issues because all of you know I was intimately involved with the Baumel, Feldman, Katz families, the missing in battle since 1982. And I know the heartache, I know the difficulty. I can tell you in a similar situation, Yonah and Miriam Valmu would not act like the Shalit parents. That I can tell you 100%. On the other hand, you think, do you want to prejudge them? It's their son. It's their child. It's a terrible, terrible situation. The government of Israel is to blame because they've made swaps all along of giving up a million for one, a million for one, a million for one. If I'm exaggerating, it doesn't matter. You get the message. And recently they gave up a murderer who wiped out a whole family to get back those bodies of the boys that were dead, that were killed up north. So the government of Israel is to blame, and the government of Israel is to blame for a lot of matters. But on the other hand, I have no right to criticize them, because when I was offered a chance to be a politician, to be high up on the Mizrahi list, I turned it down over the phone on the spot. And the person asking me was not a simple person. We're talking about Rav Chaim Drukman. And I turned it down. I told Chaim, I know where I belong. I can't leave my desk. So I have no right to criticize. You refuse, so others have to make the decisions. But I can only tell you in theory. Now, with the question of Sirif Pkuda, which again interests the people in America, it's an Israeli problem of the highest order. I can only tell you the following. In my opinion, and you can disagree, it's not that I don't believe in Das Torah, that I speak like a pope. I'm not in that religion. I'm in the Torah religion, the Jewish religion, and I'm the Talmud of the Rav, and I know his drasha and Yosef Yechav. So I don't say I'm infallible, but I feel very strongly, if we start refusing orders in the army, it's the end of the army. We're going to refuse what we believe. The leftists will refuse to serve in Yehuda Vishomer. Then we'll come up with the fact that Barak is a rodef. No, a rodef, shoot him. They'll come up that we're rodefim. Shoot him before you know it. The Arabs, my father used to say, Zichrono Livracha, if the Arabs were smart, they would just keep quiet. Oh, we love Israel, let Israel thrive. There'd be so much machloket here that they could walk in and take the country. In a moment, there'll be no opposition. This way, we're united in fighting the Arabs. The minute we don't have the Arabs to fight, you see the machloket. Look what's going on. You didn't hear the news this morning. Do you understand the Haredi world? They're closing down. Bata Yaakov will not allow a Mizrach in, a girl who is of Sephardic origins. Did you hear the news? Do you know what's going on? Parents are keeping their children home. Not to be together with a black girl. Let me put it into American context. Do you remember, where was it, in Missouri, where that girl, that little girl, had to be let in to school with bodyguards, had to get her in. What was her name? Rose Parker? Do I have the...
Rosa Parks was the one who walked in.
I know. What's her name? Rosa Parks? She, remember, she refused to give up her seat in the bus. Remember? And the world went crazy. Could you imagine a frum girl, a wonderful girl, a girl who shomeret Shabbat, a little sweet girl? The Ashkenazic girls were kept home by their parents rather than sit in the same classroom in Beis Yaakov with this Sephardic girl. And they'll tell you, yeah, because they have a television in their house. Oh, we find a Shalilam. So they have a television. I told you a minute ago, Kadesh Atzmacha B'Mutalacha. It's what you use the television for. Another story of that Yeruchim Gerelik. We were at a wedding together, and he says to me, do I have a hot machine? I think I told you this story. Do you have a car? The Yiddish word for car is mishinka, a machine. That was the original word. No one uses it today. Do I have a car to take him home? So I say to him, Rebbe, halvai I should have a car. I was a poor kid who had a car. He says, halvai, the Puerto Ricans have mishinkas. The Puerto Ricans have it. So I said, yeah, but I would use it to drive the Rebbe home for Shabbat brachas. And Zeynuts and Das Hulavin, and they use it, you know, to Chveis Hulavin. You translate that, Yitzchak. They use it to commandavai. I don't know how to translate these words. They use it, you know, for dope, drugs, women, sex. I would use it to drive the Rebbe home. Oh, and then he told me the Chafetz Chaim's what? You know the Chafetz Chaim's what? Why were trains invented? Because we're not big matmidim. So if we had to travel and go by coach, it would take 20 days. This way we go by train in 3 days, we go back to learning again. So I said, he told me the vod. So I said, that's a good vod. That's why we have cars today, to give us more time to learn. Beautiful, beautiful. All right. In subordination, in the army, not in favor. We'll divide up the most precious gift that God enabled us to develop, Tzva Hagana LiYisrael. Where the battle has to be fought is with the politicians. This is a democracy. The democracy controls the army. At least it's supposed to. And that Barak is the minister of defense, to me it's an offense to anyone who has the slightest connection with Jewish history, the Jewish people, the Torah, our past, etc. But the politicians allow him. We're talking politicians. What? Blame it on Netanyahu. Fine.
You knew what Barak was all about.
Then the pressure, you're right, so the, believe me, I'm not any big fan of Netanyahu, but that's where the pressure has to be, not in the army, and not demonstrating, and not Sirif Pekuda, and not ripping apart the fabric of something that is a miracle that we Jews have. Now,
yesterday was our statue of Truman and all the others.
Right, and he opposed them on the Sirif Pekuda, and there was those agreed with him, those didn't agree, and they finally did not reach a decision on Sirif Pekuda because there was pro and con. But on the concept of not demonstrating, there was uniformity, and there they did reach a decision. The truth is, they did not give Barak what he wanted. So Barak has not backed down, and I have a grandson doing Hezda through Habracha, and he already was told in the army he has 72 hours to find a new Hezda yeshiva, or they're going to, he'll be in the army for 3 years, he's no longer a Hezda boy. Now this is just terrible. They're taking kids in the middle of their service and putting terrible pressure on them. So he called his home yeshivas Bethel, because you go from one Rav Malamed to the other Rav Malamed, because Bethel is not Hezda. But when you go into the army, they send you to Rabbi Malamed's son, which is Habracha. So they told him, we're working on it. Shevi al tase, you're not the only one with a problem. We'll try to work it out. It's a terrible thing. It's head against head now. You have Barak. And by the way, Michael Miller is absolutely correct that Netanyahu, the pressure, the politicians, is not Barak. It's Netanyahu. How do you tolerate this man? Of course. But the politicians don't give a hoot because they have their chair. Okay. Now, and this leads to the final question I'll deal with today, the demonstrations at Intel. And I want to tell you, no one is more opposed to Chilul Shabbos than yours truly, the parking lot Intel. And I'm 1,000% against opening up that parking lot on Shabbat. But now you have to ask, who's responsible? And I heard again a brainwashed Haredi kid said to me, the government opened the parking lot. What does that have to do with the government? It has to do with the local politicians in Jerusalem. And the demonstration should not be held on Shabbos. It has nothing to do with throwing rocks at police. You should demonstrate outside the offices of Agudat Yisrael and outside the offices of Shas. Why? They control the local Jerusalem government. They're the ones that give Barkat a tremendous majority. Tell him, we're going to leave the government unless you come across, and you'll see how quickly he will shut down the parking lot. But that leads us to a different thought altogether. Many of us are so assimilated, we don't know what Yiddishkeit is all about. We're Chassidim, and we're Haredim, and we're YU people, and we know how to learn, and we're missing the whole concept of what it means to be a Jew. And this is what Yaakov Avinu couldn't believe. Yosef is alive until he saw the Agalot. And Chazal say that was the last sugya they studied together. Rashi quotes the Medrash Rabbah, and that made him realize it is my son Yosef. What is so important about the Agalot, Egla Arufa? Egla Arufa gives us a religious lesson that no other religion has. Every other religion is personal, it's you, individualistic. When it comes to Egla Arufa, Shelo Livu, Shelo Yadanu, Yadem Lo Shachu Et Adam Hazeh, it's the concept of communal responsibility. And that concept we lost in the Golah. It's a very important concept. Yosef was saying to Yaakov Avinu, I still recall our Sheirim together on Egla Rifa, on communal responsibility. I haven't lost the fact that a Jew functions both in the private domain and the public domain. And this is what we're missing today. And I can tell you, I went to the Mizrahi leaders who have no influence whatsoever today. A dead tzitzi fly has more influence in Israel than a Mizrahi leader. And they told me, what are you upset about? Some told me, let them have a parking lot on Shabbos. We're not parking there, we're not driving. The whole concept of Chilul Shabbos B'Parchesia, that we're Jews as individuals and Jews as part of B'nai Yisrael, Kal Yisrael, Adat Yisrael, a collected unity, is totally lacking. So I walked away, Mizrahi has no influence. The tragedy is that the Haredim have the same attitude. It's not in our neighborhood. It's wonderful, it's good, let them do what they want. That's where the demonstrations have to be. Not on Shabbos, not with the police, not causing Chilul Shabbos, but demonstrate the politicians. They control the city, the politicians, the government. That's my approach. Intel, as you know, is in a total frum, Shomer Shabbos, Haredi neighborhood. How can you have a place like that open on Shabbat? And once you open one, I've told you more than once, you have 10 and 100, and all of Shabbat is wiped off the public map, and people who are Shomer Shabbos can't get jobs. However, if it's true that they can't close down the production, then work it out with Arabs, with Druze who need panasa, who are reliable. You can work out a compromise that there will be no Chilul Shabbos, and yet you can keep the plant running in a way that's halachically acceptable. Perhaps that has to be worked out for the technological institutes that work with Shabbat and technological problems. If there's goodwill, the problems can be worked out, but they must be worked out because what gives us the right to the land is that we're the heirs of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and all the generations that came before us, and all the generations that will come after us. After us, Hatzbiyat Goyal Tzedek B'mheira B'yameinu. Now, there's quite a few questions I haven't touched, but they're not as important as the questions I have. In the course of time, I'll deal with them one by one on just an abbreviated 2-3 minutes out of the regular class. Now, the scheduling, listen to me very carefully, because we're in for a very different next 4 or 5 weeks. Next week, Sunday is Asara B'Tevet. So that knocks out our Sunday class, obviously. Monday, there's regular class 9:05, the final class. Tuesday, that's in Hashkafa, right? 9:05. Tuesday, I fly to England. And you should see all that. You were there now? Were you there? You saw any of the posters? Or they haven't put them up yet? They sent me endless posters. They're really, will they get a big response? I can't believe all the advertising. Wow.
Like a boxing match.
Why is there a boxing match?
Yeah, the
publicity. Okay, yeah. Baruch Hashem. So Tuesday I fly to England. I'll be gone 3 weeks. I'm giving a slew of lectures there. Then when I get back, I believe the Sunday I wanted to start is the Chag HaSmicha here. And there's a tekes and there's a dinner. So I have to talk with Abdavid. I don't think I can hold class. I think I have to be there. I don't know. Do you know about it or you don't even know about it yet? Okay. So that Monday will be a normal class, everything back to normal. But I'll put up a sign, watch the dates. I have a world to teach, and now I have a world to give out. Yitzchak, you take Rabbi Asher Weiss. Gentlemen, there was a major article in the New York Times on sex in Ramaz, Rabbi Luxton teaching a course. Very important article. I have three copies of it if anyone wants it. What this did for Ramaz fundraising is unbelievable. This is B'Machaneh, a very interesting issue. These are parents of a soldier who was killed when Gilad Shalit was captured, and they're desperate to see Gilad Shalit because he was the last one to see their son alive in the last few minutes of his life. Nebuch, the price we pay is unbelievable. This I can show you. It's just mind-boggling to me. This is someone I never met. And he was listening to my Shayurim, or listens to my Shayurim. And he asked my permission, Yaakov Weinstein, he asked my permission to put together the sources I quote in my Sunday class. So this is the year I devoted many, many years ago to Hafkat Kedushin. These are all the sources I quote. And what I said in class, what I actually quoted, he put into block letters, darker letters. I can't believe the job he did. And take a look, this is the original, this is not Bar Ilan. This is the original This is the original, how can I tell? This is print that I recognize. Bar Ilan all looks the same. Here, you can see by the print, you get an idea when it was published. These are Svatik Svarim I quoted.
This is just 1 year?
1 year, yeah, 1 year. 100, how many pages did it turn out? 100, wow. This may be Bar Ilan. It could be that he couldn't get the original. This looks like Bar Ilan print page. 107 pages of sources. Now, this, I'm told, was put on as, what's the word they use? As an appendix, as an addendum? Mm-hmm. What's the word they use? To the shirm on the... My foot hurts. On the website. What's the word they use?
Right?
No, yeah, but there's a word they use. An attachment. An attachment. Thank you. That it was put on as an attachment. What's the laughter?
There is no response to literature without life, and no life without response to literature.
What's the one they quote in Wikipedia? What's the one he quotes there? Oh, you can't be a real Zionist until you've studied Vayakhel Moshe, and Vayol Moshe. So that was one of the questions. What did I mean by that? What I meant is very simple. I'll have to answer it. That if you read the Rebbe and all and Maisa Sutton, Alekul Alef Tamura, is it God or is it Satan? I don't know. I believe in God. I don't want to go on. Let's see what I can give out. Wait, the one I didn't answer, leave. Let's see if there's anything here.
Do you have a spare copy of the Rav Schechter article?
You know they're selling still? What do you mean?
Why not?
I don't know.
You can go to a newsstand and buy it. Why shouldn't they?
You don't want the pictures?
Anyone want the article on Leib Trapper?
You didn't think it was right what he wrote, what he said at the end about the Rav.
I don't think it's right, but I don't
it
think.
It seems like that's a typical Hogan's team him and a lot of other people.
Yeah, no, it's not just him. I said to you, Rabbi Meisel agrees with him, Rabbi Twesky.
That what?
But he says himself that each student saw the Rav through his own prisma. But that's impossible.
What about his own life? He makes it sound as though the only reason he's not a lawyer is because he wouldn't have been a good lawyer.
It could be. I don't know. I can't answer. If anyone wants the Trapper scandal, this is the... I'm sickening. This is from the Jewish Action. And if anyone's interested in the Wikipedia biographies of Chaim Potok and Yerushalmi, here it is. Yeah.
Rabbi, are you going to meet this Talmud? He says in his introduction, that he's never met you before? And
I never met him.
Wow.
I'm telling you, I never met him. He asked me for permission, and this is the letter I wrote to him. What's interesting is he cut off Yeshiva University. I don't know why he did that, unless his scanner did. What, why?
No, this is a little sheet, huh?
That's what?
He still has the YU logo.
Yeah, I think that was an accident.
Yeah? I don't know. I thought maybe he wants to attract Haredim, but it doesn't make sense, everyone knows.
It still says.
Caroline Joseph. Yeah, but this is a Kollel. We're not YU wearing.
Big YU flame,
right?
YU shield.
You know why I insist they...
Pre-Joel, post-Joel.
Right, you know why I have both pre-Joel and post-Joel.
Why?
That was my chop, that I don't want to get caught in machloket, so I have both. And that's the letter I wrote him. You see, that's the letter I wrote him.
Yeah, Oshachta.
That's Oshachta, oh yeah.
Yeah, the original... The original... I'm sure they're selling it, and why should it have sold out?
What is it? You were friends with Chaim Potap?
Yes.
Why should it sold out? Is one of the most epic publications in the past year.
Oh, you mean because of the...
It's the announcement of Mashiach's coming.
I read your website, so I'm not happy.
I saw. I'm in my office. One guy wrote
Eliyahu
something.
Eliyahu Navi published this.
Someone showed me early announcement. Sent me from America. Every line has a historical mistake. He wrote a whole two-page thing against YU. You saw it?
No.
And he reminded me of bringing it into class because it's not even worth answering. You know, you can be against YU.
Did he put his name on it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Now, I pulled the line.
Yes, you do.